The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, how are you? Good. It's good seeing you. It is good being here introducing a dear, dear friend, a great writer, a wonderful human being tonight. And the thing that people know when you're writers, I have done a number of introductions for him, but I do everything longhand, right? So every time I get ready to come out, I look for it, right? And then I was looking for it, and then I had to do another one. So it just means that you just end up writing more, you know? We are never lost in the sound of the beaten. We are never lost in the sound of the beaten. We are never lost in the sound of the beaten. Everything trembles in early morning dawn. The day almost freezes in little patches of purple, and I wonder if this day will burn down the blue from the sky. How many dawns can hold a people, a country? I return to your genius, my dear brother. I watch you tell us about the genesis of E.Z. Rawlings, L. McGill, and now Joe King Oliver. What are these men's chi? What is America's chi? Is it good or bad? We see in all of your books that the legacy of racism, corruption, white supremacy, war, greed, the legacy of lives running on hairpins, the legacy of a country needing parts from people to live. Step right up. I say step right up, a good sale on legs today, eyes today, hands today, kidneys today, livers today, hearts today, children today, truth today, integrity today, women today, detectives today. There are many things we must unlearn and learn how to be free, human, and stay alive. Amen, amen, a woman, a woman, a woman. We are never lost in the sound of the beaten. We are never lost in the sound of the beaten. We are never lost in the sound of the beaten. We have been whipped, bent back like Douglas, who was beaten by the slave breaker Covey. And one day Douglas held on, broke through the beatings, became a prayer of life for himself, and was never whipped again. And like Rosa Parks, prepared herself for her assignment, remembered out loud the religious fervor of segregation, how it had tried to destroy a people, stayed in her seat for all the others who felt beaten, broken down, for all others disrespected, showed them that we are never lost, lost, lost in the sound, sound, sound of the beaten. And like Fannie Lou Hamer, working for food and shelter, tired, sick and tired of being sick and tired, always seeing the blood and dust from the beatings of bosses and men, knew as she organized, came up against the sharecropping thunder, she was never lost in the sound of the beaten. And my dear brother, you gave us brothers and sisters tasting the dust of cities, learning to lean into each other's breath and breathe as one, to live, not die, never to fall down again in the muck and mire of money where you threaten girls and women with your power, your sex, your death. You showed us that this is about never, 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 ever, never, 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 ever getting lost in the sound of the beaten, in the sound of the beaten, never getting lost in the sound of the beaten. In Japan, it is said that the words of the soul resides in a spirit called Kotodama, or the spirit of words, and the act of speaking words has the power to change the world. That has been your mission, my dear brother, to help change the world through the words of your characters, your friends who are attempting always to flush the world's flesh with peace and dignity, and they are one, alive, apart from the elasticity of the dead. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Like monk, my dear brother, round midnight, light runs to meet your eyes. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. This is like such a great place to be. And, you know, I can't say that I always look forward to it because I think, well, God, I'll never be here again. You know, but it was wonderful, you know. I've been on tour, which is kind of a surprise for me. And people have liked this book, which is another surprise for me. And you know, because I'm thinking, my head is like way far ahead of where I am, you know. So I'm thinking up there, you know, the thing you shouldn't do, but I've been doing it, and it's been working. But you know, I usually just kind of run right into, and I'll tell you what I'm going to do with this book. But I was just thinking these things. I was, you know, coming down here. I was having this talk with this guy, and you know, I was saying something that I think is good to say again, you know, because. You know, the wealth in the world is finite because wealth is based on labor. It's just like a long, long time ago, you know, when, you know, our grandparents used to barter, you know, or whoever, somebody a long time ago. And like you would have a, you know, a fish and then you would have a, you know, like a tomato. And you would say, well, here, you take my fish and I'll take your tomato. And that's like, you know, what people would do, right? And that. And money is that same thing. It just concretizes those things. And I just remember it because, you know, every time I hear about that somebody's a billionaire and how great he or she is, I think, yeah, but for every dollar they have over, you know, what their labor creates, that's a dollar they're taking from somebody else, you know? It's a good thing to remember, you know? And also, talking about things to remember, I'm so, like, happy to, like, you know, just be in a room with Sonia. I mean, that it's great because, you know, she's so wonderful. You know, she's kind of like our Yeats, you know. You know, it's true, you know, because Yeats is, the reason people love Yeats is because he talked about people's lives. If like 63 people were killed, like, you know, fighting the English in the streets, you know, of Ireland, he would write their names down and in the poem that he was writing. You know, it wasn't like, poetry was something over there, you know. You know, I love T.S. Eliot, but, you know, I mean, he's not my poet. You know, he's just a poet, and he's really good. But, you know, but Sonia is our poet. And you know, the older you get, the more you tell these stories, you know, like kind of some of the stories in your life. One of them was, one day, quite a few years ago, I was walking Sonia to a train in Grand Central Station. So there were like 10,000 people. And this very tall young brother in some kind of uniform-y thing saw Sonia and he goes, "Miss Sanchez?" He didn't know her, he just knew what she looked like. And she said, "Yes, brother." And she looks up at him and he said, "Yeah, he's really tall." And he's saying, "Miss Sanchez, listen, it's just the Lord was there. He just brought you to me, because my sister," and really he started his sister, had this boyfriend, and she got pregnant, but the boyfriend left, and he was going on, he wasn't really telling, the story was kind of disjointed. And Sonia grabbed him by like his fingers, and she said, "Does she want to have that baby?" And he said, "Yes, Ms. Sanchez, I think she does." And she wrote down her phone number. She says, "I'll be home by 11 o'clock. You have her call me tonight." And I'm just standing there going, "What? What? What just happened?" Like, you know, I mean, but of course she's our Yeats, so that makes sense. You know, that she's going to be there. So her poetry isn't, you know, like hidden, you know, in some part of the library where you don't have the key. You know, it's not something where that if you don't, you know, speak both ancient Latin and Greek, that you can't understand the poem. It's not like she's worried. I mean, she does all the kind of wonderful forms, haiku, all that other stuff. But like, but the thing is it basically, she's worried about me and that guy in the station. And I just thought, wow, that is so great, you know. I mean, and a lot of people don't get that, I think a lot of people don't understand because, you know, they want whatever their labor is to make them different and better than other people. And that's not something that Sonia Sanchez ever does. So that's kind of wonderful, you know? That's really, really wonderful, you know? I mean, and it's not like it's a specific generation. You know, I don't believe in elders, you know? Some people just get old, you know? And they're old. They're old people and cranky. And they say, you owe me shit. And I say, I don't owe you nothing, man. You know, what are you talking about? You ain't done nothing for me, you know? But some people are elders, you know? Ruby Dee was. Certainly Sonia Sanchez. Also Ossie was, you know? These are some great people who worried about people and who knew people, you know? And when I say know people, I really mean, like, they know people, you know? And so anyway, so I'm so happy to see you tonight, Sonia. So I wrote this book, Down the River, Unto the Sea, though that's not the name I gave it. I had an argument with my publisher and lost. But I did name it. I just, that wasn't my original name. I originally wanted to call it Detective Heal Thyself. And I think it's kind of clear why. I'm going to read to you from the very beginning. It's only like 4 or 5 pages I'm going to read because I learned when I wrote my first book that the longer you read to people, the less likely they are to buy your book. And, you know, I'm not here for my health, you know. So I'm going to read short, and then I'm going to... But the problem is I'm going to read from the beginning, and the beginning doesn't really say why I wrote the book. And so then I'm going to talk a little bit to explain why I wrote it. And then I'll answer questions. And that'll be that. I'll be finished. I can go back before the nor'easter comes. The nor'easter, yeah. Looking out from my second floor window onto Montague Street is better than the third floor view. From here, you can almost make out the lines and the faces of the hundreds of working people moving past, people who, more and more, have no reason to walk through the doors of the fancy shops and banks that have made their claim on that thoroughfare. These new businesses are like modern-day prospectors panning for gentrified golden customers who will buy the million-dollar condos and fancy clothes, eat in the French bistros, and buy wine for $100 a bottle. When I took this office almost 11 years ago now, there were used bookstores, secondhand clothes shops, and enough fast food to feed that displaced army of workers in Brooklyn Heights. That's when Christoph Hale offered me a 20-year renewable lease because another cop, Gladstone Palmer, had overlooked his son, Leif Hale's, involvement in a brutal attack on a woman whose only offense was to say no. 3 years later, Leif went to prison for another beating that got bargained down to manslaughter. But this had nothing to do with me. I had the lease by then. My maternal grandmother always tells me that every man gets what he deserves. 13 years earlier, I was a cop, too. I would have tried to put Leif in prison for the first assault, but that's just me. Not everyone sees the rules the same. The law is a flexible thing on both sides of the line, influenced by circumstance, character, and, of course, wealth or lack of same. My particular problem with women was, at one time, my desire for them. It didn't take but a smile and a wink for me, Detective First Class Joe King Oliver, to walk away from my duties and promises, vows, and common sense for something, or just a promise of something, that was as transient as a stiff breeze, a good beer, or a street that couldn't maintain its population. For the last 13 years, I've been somewhat less influenced by my sexual drives. I still appreciate the opposite, sometimes known as the fairer sex, but the last time I acted on instinct, I ran into so much trouble that I believed I was pretty much cured of my roaming ways. Her name was Nathalie Malcolm. She was a modern-day Tallulah Bankhead with a husky voice, quick wit, and that certain something that defined the long-ago starlet. My dispatcher, the same Sergeant Gladstone Palmer, called via cell phone to give me the assignment. "It should be easy, Joe," Palmer assured me. "It's basically a favor for the chief of D's. But I'm on that port side then, Glad. Little Exeter always makes his move on Wednesdays. That means he'll be doing it next Wednesday and the one after that," my sergeant reasoned. Gladstone and I had come through the academy together. He was white Irish and I was a deep shade of brown, but that never affected our friendship. "I'm close, Glad," I said, "real close. That may very well be, but Bennett's in the in a hospital bed with a punctured lung, and Brewster messes up 2 out of every 5 collars. You need a point or two on your sheet this year anyway. You spend so much time at the docks, you don't make half the arrests you need to keep your numbers up. He was right. The one place the law was not flexible was in statistics. Criminal arrests and convictions, the retrieval of stolen property, and competent investigation that leads to crime solution were what our professional careers hinged upon. I had a big case in front of me, but it might be a year before I could wrap it up. What's the offense, I asked. GTA? Just one cop for a chop shop? Nathalie Malcolm stole a Benz from Tremont Bendix of the Upper East Side. A woman car thief? Order came down from up top. I guess Bendix got friends. It's just a single woman lives alone in Park Slope. They say the park is parked out in front of the brownstone. All you have to do is ring the bell and slap on some cuffs. You got paper on her. It'll be waiting for you at the station. And Kang? What? Glad only used my middle name when he wanted to make a point. Don't mess it up. I'll send you a text with all the details. The purple Benz was parked in front of her place. It had the right plates. I looked at the front door, flanked by full-length windows and that were swathed in yellow curtains. I remember thinking that was the easiest arrest I'd ever been sent on. Yes, she said, opening the door maybe a minute after I rang. Her tan eyes seemed to be staring through a fog at me. She had red hair and the rest pure Tallulah. My grandmother likes old movies. When I visit her in the Lower Manhattan retirement home, we watch old love stories and comedies on TCM. Ms. Malcolm, I said. Yes, I'm Detective Oliver. I have a warrant for your arrest. Your what? I took out the leather folder and with my shield and ID. These I showed her. She looked, but I'm not sure she registered anything. Tremont Bendix claims you stole his car. Oh, she sighed. And shook her head slightly. Come in, detective, come in. I could have grabbed her right there, put on the restraints while reciting her rights as the Supreme Court detailed them, but this was a soft arrest and the lady was feeling tender, vulnerable. Anyway, little Exeter Barrett had already connected with the captain of the Sea Frog. The shipment of heroin wouldn't be in for a few more days. I was a good cop, the kind of officer who had yards of patience and lost his temper only when threatened physically by some suspect. And even then, I took no joy in beating him after he'd been subdued and restrained. Would you like some water? Nathalie Malcolm asked. The good stuff's all been packed away. The living room was filled with boxes, bulging duffel bags and piles of books, electronic equipment, along with clusters of potted plants. What's going on here? I asked, as if reciting a line that had been written for me. This is what Tree calls me stealing his car. She was wearing a sheer and shimmery green house coat with nothing underneath. I hadn't paid close attention at first. When I got there, I was still intent on the job. I don't understand, I said. For the past 3 years, he's paid my rent and left me the Benz to use as my car, she said. Her tan eyes had turned golden under electric light. Then his wife threatened to divorce him, and he told me to get out and bring his car back to his uptown garage. I see. I have to move, Detective. What's your name again? Joe. When Nathalie smiled and shifted her shoulders, the structure of our temporary relationship changed from potential handcuffs to definite bedsheets. Nathalie was very good in bed. She knew how to kiss, and that is the most important thing to me. I need to be kissed and kissed a lot. She intuited this necessity, and we spent the better part of the afternoon and way into the evening discovering new and exciting ways and places to kiss. She was a victim. I could see that in her eyes, hear it in her deep voice. And the arrest warrant was wrong. A man leaving his car at a girlfriend's house, a house he paid the rent on, had no expectation of returning that automobile to his garage. The next morning, I'd make my report and get back to the docks where the real crime was happening. When I opened my eyes, Monica Lars, my wife at that time, was already awake and making breakfast for her and Asia Denise, our 6-year-old daughter. I awoke to the smell of coffee and the memory of Nathalie kissing my spine in a place I could not reach. I'd left her when my shift was over. I'd showered and changed at the station and got home in time for a supper. Drowsing for the last time in my morning bed, I took in a deep, satisfied breath, and then the doorbell rang. The bedroom of our queen's home was on the second floor, and I wasn't due into work until the afternoon. I was naked and very tired. Anyway, Monica knew how to answer a door. I stretched a bit, thinking how much I love my little family and that a promotion to captain was not an impossibility once I single-handedly busted the largest heroin ring that ever existed within the borders of the greatest city on earth. Joe, Monica yelled from the entrance hall, which was downstairs and all the way to the front of the house. What? I bellowed. It's the police. The one thing a cop's wife never says is, it's the police. That's what criminals and the victims of criminals say. Sometimes we said it about ourselves while pointing a service revolver at the back of some perp's head. The mayor called us the police, and now and then the newspapers did. But a cop's wife saying, it's the police, would be like my black-skinned grandmother calling out to my ex-sharecropper grandfather that it's some Negroes at the dough. I knew there was something wrong and that Monica was trying to warn me. I had no idea that that would be the last loving act in our marriage or that her call heralded the end of any kind of normal life that I could expect. That's all I'm reading. You know, I was watching, there's this thing on, I don't know, Stars, you know, premier station. They have a documentary on the Pulitzer Prize, you know, and they had Toni Morrison on there, and Toni Morrison was saying, you know, I was sitting there and my book was there and I opened it and I turned to the first page and I read it, and I turned the page and I read another one and I read another one, you know, and I thought, this is a very good book. I kind of love that. It's like, yeah. Right, exactly, you know. We love ourselves. We love what we do. I like this. But, you know, listen, I wrote this book. Nobody had bought it or anything like that. I just wrote it. And the reason I did, you know, because I've been doing a lot of TV and, you know, film work. And I get a little, it's fun, but, you know, it's like eating marshmallows. You know, after a while, you crave something else. And so I wrote this book because, you know, I've always, you know, there's Eddie Conway down in Baltimore, Mumia, I know you know, in Philadelphia. There are black men and women all over the country who have been so set upon by the police. I mean, it's bad enough just walking down the street, but if you're also writing about it, talking about it, you know, getting people upset about it, that's like putting a target on your forehead. It really is. And, you know, sometimes, you know, people do bad things. Sometimes black people do bad things. They need to be arrested. They need to be put in jail. But sometimes you have to wonder, so, well, you know, like when he saw that those lights in his, you know, in his rearview mirror, what was he thinking? So I decided I was going to write about a cop detective and a guy who's in prison for murdering two cops in New York and been sentenced to death. My cop detective doesn't like this guy. He don't like people who attack cops, shoot cops. He would be happy. But he needed to get the money so he could figure out the thing about Natalie Malcolm. So he said, okay, I'll take the case, and I will follow it until I prove that he did it, you know, and it wasn't self-defense. And the woman who hires him says, fine. And so he keeps doing it. He keeps looking into his own case, looking into hers. And both of them, he proves he didn't do it, and he has a witness. He proves that the guy didn't do it. He killed the cops, but it was self-defense. But nobody listens. They say, okay, you proved that you didn't do this, but you're still not a cop. And they say, yeah, you may think you proved this about this guy in prison, but he's still gonna be executed. And so, now when you get that close to something and your knowledge is that clear, you can't pretend ignorance. You either have to hate yourself or step out of the box. That's what I thought. And really, that was a problem I gave myself. I didn't know what he was going to do till I got to the end of the book. Because, you know, that's the best way. You know, you got to worry about what will he do now that he knows the truth, right? And that's why I wrote the book. I'm not going to tell you what happens at the end, because that's another thing if you tell people they don't buy the book. And so that's the purpose of creating this character. You know, who's not a perfect character by any means, and his friends who are even less perfect, and just to follow it long enough to be able to say, you know. Yeah, this is what I think, you know. And I'm not courageous enough to do it, so I'm gonna write it down. And that's that. So now that's done. I've done my reading, the short one, so somebody will buy a book. And now I will answer questions, statements, minor criticisms. Minor, only minor. Yeah. No major criticisms. Was there a hand somewhere?
You mentioned Yeats, and I've read somewhere that Edna O'Brien was influential on your decision to become a writer, and I was wondering if you were still in touch with her.
You know, I see Edna now and again. I actually saw her on a documentary about Yeats not that long ago. You know, it's funny because, you know, she mentions me in her, whatever that is, autobiography, memoir, I don't know what you call it exactly, but you know, I mean, I have to stop and say that I think Edna's the greatest living writer in the English language. But other than that, she said in this thing, in her wonderful language, something that was true, but not salient. She said, Walter Mosley, what did she say? She says, I told Walter that he was black and he was Jewish, and with these rich histories, he would have a lot to say. And, you know, he went on to say it. And I'm like, I knew I was black and Jewish. You know, what's this? You know, I mean, what are you talking about? You know? It's more, you know, like my detective. If you ever see pictures of her and Jackie Onassis together, you're not looking at Jackie Onassis, I'm going to tell you that right now. And she was just so unbelievably beautiful, and still is. And also, one day, I wrote a chapter. I thought it was a story, but it was really a chapter. And she said, Walter, write a novel. And I did. You know, it's like, because what am I going to do? Edna O'Brien told me to write, the greatest writer in English language told me to write a novel. I'm going to write it. And then she read it. And she, you know, the only thing she criticized was the title, and I couldn't figure out how to change it. I liked her criticism, I just didn't understand it, you know, at that time. And, you know, so that, I mean, yes, so she had an incredible impact on me. You know, it's just not the impact she thought she had, which I kind of think is very novelistic. Yes?
Welcome to Philadelphia, Walter Lamont Steptoe.
Hi, doing Lamont.
Has the current administration inspired you to begin work on a novel?
God, can illiteracy make me want to write a novel? You know, I as much, you know, Bobcat Goldthwait had a joke in the 80s about Reagan, who was president at the time. And he said, I don't like Ronald Reagan. I hate Ronald Reagan, he said. But I can't blame Ronald Reagan for my problems. I said, blaming Ronald Reagan for your problems is like blaming Ronald McDonald if you get a bad cheeseburger. I just thought that was the best political joke I had ever heard. I still think so. I said, oh, wow, the president is Ronald McDonald. And the corporation is the United States government. Right, right, I got to remember that. You know, George W. Bush was so much of a worse president than Trump could ever hope to be. I mean, he did that whole thing about, like, you know, destroying the Middle East. Like, for no reason whatsoever. You know, I don't think that, I just think if Trump even thought of doing something like that, he would trip and fall and hit his head. You know, it's like it's hard to be inspired by him because because I know the trouble with him is what he represents, but what he represents is America. And I have trouble with that. You know, I have trouble with all these people who like, now that they're experiencing life the way, you know, the descendants of slaves experience life, they're mad, you know? But they're mad at the wrong thing. And so that's the thing. So I might actually write about that, you know? But to write about Trump would be, God, a waste of... of everything, yeah.
The main character in your book is Joe King Oliver.
Yeah.
King Oliver, as we know, is a famous jazz musician in New Orleans. But why add Joe?
Well, actually, that jazz musician's name was Joe King Oliver. That's one thing. But the other thing is that, you know, I mean, the book, you know, like you say, the mother from Chicago says, we can't call our son King. He's going to have all kinds of trouble at school. You know, kids are going to pick on him. So the father said, okay, we'll call him Joe. Fine. You know, like, I mean, that's the reason. But the thing is that jazz is central to the mindset of the main character. And it starts with his father naming him, you know, and it goes all the way, you know, like through the novel. It's not a jazz novel, kind of like Devil in a Blue Dress is, but but it has a sense of, it's informed by the sensibility of jazz, you know. I was really, you know, like there are great people in America that you run across every once in a while. I had a teacher of poetry named William Matthews, and Bill was brilliant. He knew everything. Honestly, you could just ask him any question about anything whatsoever, and he knew the answer to it. And he knew where it came from, and he knew everything. But that never made its way into his poetry, which is a neat trick. But the other thing is that one day I asked him, I said, so Bill, what do you think is the greatest art of the 20th century? And now everybody, any artist you ask thinks it's their art. I mean, really, honestly, they just say, oh, it's sculpture, oh, it's painting, oh, it's, you know. And he said, oh, it's jazz. Yeah, it's jazz. Jazz is America. And, you know, he's kind of right about that. He's kind of right. And I just kind of love it that, you know, that. But you have to be open enough to accept it. And I hopefully my character is.
Your books for years, how long have you been writing?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, all these people are trying to make me old. Like, people used to say to me, you know, I read your books. And then some time went by and they said, oh, my father reads your books. And then, and then they started saying, my grandfather reads your books. And I'm not making fun of this, but then a lot of people have said to me, oh, yes, the last book my father read before he died was your book, you know? And then they would say to me, I have been reading your books since, you know, like the late 70s. And, you know, and my first book was published in 1990, you know? So, like, I'm like, the late 70s? I wasn't writing books in the late 70s. I wasn't even thinking about it. I started when I was 34 years old. I wrote a sentence. I really liked it. On hot, sticky days in southern Louisiana, the fire ants swarmed. I said, that's a good sentence. That could be in a book. And it must be fiction because I'd never been to Louisiana. I'd never seen a fire ant. So I'm making it up. And so, you know, anyway, that's the answer. Yes?
Mr. Mosley, I love your work. It's like taking a master class when I read your work. And my question for you is, there was a type of writing you used to do, used to code. You were a programmer.
Oh, yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Is there something about writing in that way that lends itself or that crosses over to the way you compose and draft and edit and think about your structure and characters?
I wish it was, but it isn't. It's not at all. It's just something I did to make money, you know, really, honestly. And I said that to somebody the other day. I just wrote an episode for this show that John Singleton has on FX called Snowfall. And I just wrote the third episode, the second season. And somebody said, aren't you happy? And I said, about what? I said, well, you know, you wrote the thing. I said, well, we wrote it in a room. You know, I mean, it wasn't just me. And then they said, well, you know, but aren't you happy to see your words on the screen? And I just looked at this woman. I said, look, I did it for the money. You know, like, I'm happy about it. I think it's really good, you know. But you know, a lot of things we do because, you know, we want to make money. And obviously I don't do that with novels because I write them with nobody saying they have bought them. And believe me, a lot of people don't want to buy my novels. But, you know, it's really shocking how many people. You know, Toni Morrison, I was listening to her one day. She was saying that, you know, she had gone to 17 publishers, you know, before she got her first book published. And I'm like, damn, that was her first book, you know. I just had that experience on my 54th book, you know. It's like, damn. Anyway.
What about Easy Rollins? Is he coming back anytime soon?
Yes, he is. You know, I have a book, and I have it outlined, and somebody's actually bought it. It's Doubleday. However, I'm working on a musical. I'm trying to do Devil in a Blue Dress as a musical. And so I want to wait until I do that before I, because it's, you know, it's not like I expect books to make me money, but if I have a musical out and I have a book, that might help, you know. You know, it won't be Hamilton or anything, but, you know.
It's not a question. I just want to say I enjoy you. And you're writing, and you're like the guy on the block that everybody, your whole court, you sound like an average guy, a nice guy. And I wanted to say the gentleman, the security guard on duty, spoke to you. And he was talking about how down to earth you were. And I just wanted to pass that on.
Well, you know, and I thank you very much. And one of the things is that, you know, when people ask me about writing, you know, because a lot of people learn writing in the university, and that's problematic, because the university is not just thinking about writing. They're also, you know, thinking what they think about Shakespeare and thinking what they think about Dostoevsky, you know, and so, like, you know, it's, you get kind of, you get put in a hierarchical kind of thinking, right? It's like, well, who, you know, who's the best writer? Who's the best writing? What's the debate? You know, all that other stuff, you know, and of course, there are a lot of things, you know, that bring me to being a writer. You know, reading comic books was a big influence on me. You know, but one of the biggest that I never knew until I started writing was my father, because he was a great storyteller. You know, my father would start telling stories, and that was it. Everybody was laughing. Everybody was having a good time. They weren't all happy. Sometimes I got really mad at him about the way he told stories. But they were having a great time. And, you know, that's really, like, that's what my imagination is, that I'm with my favorite cousin, Alberta, and we're sitting in a train, and she's saying, well, what happened with that mouse? And I said, well, man, you know, mouse, he killed that policeman. She said, oh, he did, you know. And my audience is the person sitting in front of us, right? That's the way I'm thinking, you know, because that's the best way, you know, to think about the work.
One of my favorite characters was Socrates. Will you ever write more about that character?
Yeah, no, I love Socrates. You know, I love Socrates because, you know, he's in my way of thinking, our philosopher. You know, and I'll tell you how that came about. One time, my publisher, I'd written, you know, another E.Z. Rollins novel. I think it might have been Black Betty, and my publisher at that time, like his wife at that time, says, well, you know, you're black and you're Jewish, so what we're going to do is we're going to send you on a tour of Southern Jewish book festivals. I was completely happy about that because, you know, I knew everybody was going to buy the book and I knew everybody was going to read the book before I got there. And, you know, I mean, it was going to be great, right? But always, right here, there are three ladies. And they were as old then as I am now. And they were looking at me and they said, well, Mr. Mosley, we really like your book, but we are wondering where your mother is. We see your father, but we want to know where your mother is in that book. And, you know, and I just made up some shit, you know. And and they said, no, 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 it's the part where Easy was reading Hadrian. And I'm saying, Hadrian's not Jewish? She said, oh, yeah, but we know your mother. Every book festival, those three ladies were there, right? Same seats. They were just sitting there saying the same thing. And I wasn't mad, but I really, like, you know, I would say things like, well, black people read, black people are smart. And they say, yes, but your mother is, we're Jewish and we know. And so, like, so I said, I got to create a philosopher that these three ladies are not going to claim. I just have to do it. There could be other people that they do claim. I don't mind. They have Easy, obviously. But like, and so then that's when I started to write about Socrates. I said, well, where would he, did he learn it in Africa? No. Did he learn it in university? No. Did he learn it in church? No. He learned it in the black man's university, prison. You right? And I said, so he's gonna come out like that. And I'm still happy with it. You know, I just can't keep. I have to take a break in between those books because it takes a lot out of me in some way.
I have a couple questions.
Yes.
I first heard about you in Spokane, Washington, when you came out for the Get Lit Festival. And unfortunately, I didn't get to see you then. I'm wondering if you'll ever, what will bring you back to Spokane? And my second question, because we're headed home tomorrow, we're going back to Spokane tomorrow. And my second question is, after Edna O'Brien, who are some of your favorite authors?
Well, To begin with, Spokane is—it's always not when am I going there, but when is my publisher sending me there? That becomes the thing, right? You know, so either someone's going to hire me to come give a talk there, or my publisher's going to send me there. You know, because you know, I used to hitchhike back and forth across country. I used to. I mean, I have no hair now, but it used to be really big, and I would be hitchhiking, but I don't do that anymore. You know, I say, man, I was in Spokane, man. Shit, I got high and laid in Spokane. You know, that's a desert out there. They got cowboys in Spokane, you know. But that aside, when you say the people who you like, you know, I'm always, you know, because I know it's about influence, and you know, and I love to talk to audiences that listen to people to ask them other writers who influences them, because everybody lies. And I mean, everybody lies. They just lie. Young black woman, they say, well, who do you read? And she said, well, I read Phyllis Wheatley, because that's because she thinks you don't know her. She says, and Zora Neale Hurston, that's because she thinks you do know her. And then she would say, and Toni Morrison, and Alice Walker, and, you know, Sonia Sanchez, and they go on and on and on, because, and, you know, then, you know, Zadie Smith, Edwidge Danticat, you know, like, all these black women who write these books. And it's just because they want you to compare them to those writers, when indeed the writer that influenced them, or wasn't even a writer, was just a character, Nancy Drew, right? They were reading Nancy Drew. They were 8 years old. They were in that. She was a black girl, and she lived across the street in that big house that she always wanted to be in, and she just lived it. I mean, it was like, you know, when you're a kid reading, it's just an amazing experience that, you know, that you rarely get as an adult. Now, if you gave an 8-year-old child Beloved, that'd be a problem. She said, Mom, either I'm going to have to kill you or you're going to have to kill me, because this this is not hitting my spot. Yeah, I don't get this shit, you know. And so, like, you know, so like I'm saying, you know, my father, you know, and his stories, which I still tell. You know, because they're so wonderful. Or Jack Kirby in Marvel Comics, who could make things happen, who invented the Black Panther, right? I mean, I'm just saying, like, this is, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah, and also I read Langston Hughes. I read Albert Camus. I love Gogol. I think he's like one of the great, great, great writers. Flannery O'Connor. I like all those people, but I don't want people to think that that has anything to do with me. I just like reading those books. You know, reading and writing are not the same thing. A lot of people say, well, you know, of course you have to read a lot, and they nod at me, and I go, no. No, Homer was blind and illiterate, and he's like the greatest novelist in the tradition, right? Like, you know, I mean, really, it's true, you know? And so, yeah, so I love reading stuff. I just don't want to make, you know, I like reading stuff the reason other people like reading stuff, because it's fun. You know, not because it has impact. I know you didn't ask that question, but, you know, I want to make sure that, you know, that's how what I do when I go out. People ask me questions, I just say what I want, you know. Yes?
I guess I got a comment and a question about one of your books. It was a standalone book, and it was one of the most powerful things I ever read, which is The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And... the comment is I wonder if you, or I guess it is a question, if you had ever considered writing a spinoff on that book. Obviously, can't be a sequel of the Robin character in mm-hmm. that. She's smart. She can handle herself. She's got a good heart. She would make a great main character for a series, I thought.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think you're wrong about that. And that's it. Is there another part to this?
Yeah. Question too.
Yeah.
What struck me most powerfully about that book is how were you able to speak from the mind of someone with advanced Alzheimer's?
Mm-hmm.
As if this was something that you had experienced, but it's something that is so so convincingly done that you feel like you're experiencing that you somehow know what that's like. How are you able to do that?
Okay, I can answer that question. I was watching a documentary on a concert, and this woman was telling this guy the notes to play on the violin, and after she finished, he goes, "I know all those notes, you know." it was just so cute. I'll answer the last question first. The thing about it was, my mother, it was kind of just slowly sunk into dementia, right? My father died some years before. My mother is, really smart, was able to hide it for a really long time, and then struggled. And I'm in New York, she's in LA, all kinds of things, like I'm trying to take care of her, I'm to make sure she's all right, And that was trouble. And then I got this, institution to help me. And they do help, but you got to watch them, because they were saying, well, you should just put her in a home. And I said, well, I want to put her in a home because she doesn't want to go to a home. She doesn't know what she wants. I said, well, I don't know. I ask her every day. And every day she answers the question the same way. She goes, no, I don't want to be there. I took her to one. I showed it to her, and she cried. I said, so I really think she doesn't want to be in one, so I wanted to stay in her home. I said, well, it's just too much trouble. I said, well, when I was a kid, my mother, 2 years old, she saved my life every day. Every day she saved my life. Sometimes more than once, because I was, mobile. And stop that, and you pick you up, put you down, It's like, and it's just like a normal thing. I said, so if she could do that for me, I can do that for her, right? In order to do that for her, I had to learn how to communicate with her. And that was like, walking downstairs, right? Because every day it was a little bit more difficult, stuff like that. One woman, I came and was taking care of my mother, and my mother told me 3 times that she didn't like her, so I fired her, and she called me, and she said, I hear you, you're letting me go, and I said, yeah. She said, may I ask you why? And I said, well, it's because my mother didn't like you. And she stopped for a minute, and she went, is that the only reason? And I said, the fact you asked me that question proves she's right. You don't need another reason. Right? And so having all that language in my head, I needed it to come out. I needed to work it, because there's a beauty about dementia, right? At certain moments in it, when it's really, really, really extreme, maybe not, but in the beginning, it's not like they don't remember, it's that all time exists, all at once. You're 10 years old, you're 90 years old, you're 50 years old, your father's still alive, everything is still happening. Is that the dog? What dog? Oh, that dog we had 50 years ago. It's a kind of a wonderful moment. And to get in there is what I wanted to do. I wrote, my editor told me, he said, you need to cut 10,000 words out of the first half, because the first half is all in dementia. And I tried for a year. I said, because I would have liked it to have been a shorter book, but I couldn't do it. Because, you had to go through all of that. If you're not interested, fine. Fuck you. I don't even have to go through it, It's like, and if you're interested, most people deal with dementia, right? Most people, it's important to think about loving the person that's not exactly the same person you knew. And that was great. That was really wonderful. And thank you for mentioning it, because, it's one of those books that, I write these books and they say, oh, Walter Moser, the mystery writer. And I go, yeah, but I wrote this. He said, yeah, mystery writer. That's a mystery. I think it was that book that won Best Mystery of the Year in the New York Times. I think it was this one. It was amazing. I'm going, but there's no mystery. There's no detective, There's a kind of a girl with a bad temper, but other than that, Anything else? Thoughts, notions, ideas?
Thank you for your work. I've read many of your books, and thank you for coming here this evening. I began to read 47, and I couldn't continue. It was just so disturbing how you depicted the misery of people in slavery. Mm-hmm. It was done very powerfully and beautifully written. I wonder if other people, anybody else here, has a problem like that. You love the book, you can tell that it's a great book. It hurts so much to read it, I just couldn't do it. Sorry.
Well, you know, that's okay. I don't mind if you don't want to read it. I mean, or can't, you know. I mean, but let me explain to you why I wrote it, which is the opposite of what you're saying. Patrick Chamoiseau, a wonderful novelist from Guadeloupe, made a film called Middle Passage. And the film was like if 220 years ago you got on a slave ship with a video camera and documented everything that was happening. It was incredibly beautiful and powerful. HBO did it, and they wanted me to translate it, you know, because the language he used, the direct translation didn't work, so it had to say other things. And so I said, "Yeah, sure, that's great, let's do it," you know. And I did it. And then I would go to all, you know, I live in New York, right? So like, there's all these events with like, you know, fancy black people, you know, who write books. And I go, hey, did you see that thing I did, you know? Because, you know, I'm not going to ask them if I read a book, but maybe saw a film. And I said, like, you know, like, you see it? And they went, oh, yeah, I saw the first 5 minutes. It was too sad. I had to turn it off. Again and again and again. And this was sad. It ended up with the guy with the camera dying. I mean, you know, it was awful. It was really, really, really dark, much darker than 47. And I'd said, well, we need to talk about this stuff. And we have problems doing it because it's so sad. And who wants to identify completely with being victimized? And so what I did is I said, I'm going to write a thing. It's going to be for children, but adults can read it. It's going to be science fiction. And we're going to know from the first page that the character we're following is going to survive slavery and thrive in his life. And I said, if I can do that, then people might be able to stick with it. And that has been the case. You know, I realized that it is there's some darkness to the book, you know. But the recognition has to be, you know, no white man with a beard is going to make me free. You know, freedom comes from me thinking I'm free. That's when you see a tiger in a cage and you say, that's a tiger in that cage. If that cage goes away, me too. You know, it's like, you know, because the tiger's free. He don't like the bars, but the tiger is free. And that's actually what the book is about, to identify freedom inside yourself and to move forward with that.
Yeah. Hi, how are you? What motivates your passion? Out of all the books you've written, what motivates your passion to just keep doing what you're doing?
You know, I was once asked. I was like, I went to like a fancy people's house somewhere in the Midwest, Minneapolis, I think, and somebody asked me. They said, you know, where do you get the drive? How do you keep doing it? Where do you get the inspiration? And I said, you know, like, imagine you have this girlfriend, and she says, well, what's your morning regimen like? He said, well, the first thing, me and my husband wake up and we have vigorous sex for an hour and a half, and then I go on with my day. And now you might think a lot of things about it. You might think, that guy, or don't you get tired, or don't you? But you would never think where you get the inspiration from. You know where you get the inspiration from. I love writing. You know, like, I love writing. Like, I really, when people say, what's the best thing about being a writer? And I say, writing. It's like, writing. It's like, you know, it's not like, you know, I met these fancy people, you know, I did this, I did that. It has nothing to do with it, you know? It has to do with, like, if I can sit down every day. There's an article I did in the Hollywood Reporter. It's the current version. It's online. It's also, you know, in the magazine. And they called me and they said, well, we'd like you to say if In the Heat of the Night is still relevant, right? And I went, damn, that's a good question. Because this year, it's the anniversary of 5 Oscars they won. 5 Oscars that movie won. And I went, wow, you know, because I haven't seen the movie in 48 years, right? So I don't remember, really. And I watched it, and I went, oh, damn, man. Poitier, he's just something. And Steiger, too, man. Those two together. It was just a joint. You know, Poitier, the consummate star, right? And Steiger, the character actor, liked to beat all character actors, really. I mean, he could stand up against anybody, like acting. And, you know, Poitier saying things like, be cool, Harvey. And I say, you dig, man? I'm not like, I can't even imagine Poitier saying it, but he said it, and it was great. And it was so perfect because they hit every note that we are dealing with today. You know, it was the biggest movie in the country. That's why people say, well, are you going to do a movie now? Because, you know, it's easy to make black movies now. I said, listen, Black Panther means I got a 6 to 9 month window, and then it's over. You know, there was no movie bigger than Heat of the Night. No movie. But, you know, they didn't make, they made a couple of more of those movies, and they weren't good, you know. And, you know, it's because it's just another, you know, it's hard. You know, but it was a great movie. And writing that article, I was so happy. It took me 4 days, you know, and I just, damn, I got to write this. I got, you know, and it was, you know, that was, I'm glad it's out. I hope you guys read it. But still, the best thing is writing.
Hi, I miss Fearless Jones. Do you think you'll write another book about him?
Now, did you read Charcoal Joe?
No.
He's in Charcoal Joe. He is actually, like, Mouse isn't, like, doesn't spend much time in it. And Fearless Jones is, like, his, like, sidekick in that. And Fearless is just so cool. I love Fearless, you know. He's, like, my second favorite character. My favorite character is Twill in the Leon and McGill series. But Fearless is, like right after that. Because he's just, like, you know, when he saves you, it's a religious experience, you know. Like, other people save you, and it's like, oh, that's good, he saved me, you know. And you forget after a while. But whatever Fearless does, it's so amazing that he's able to do what he does. And, you know, and that he's not so smart, you know. But that doesn't matter because his heart is really smart. And, you know, I really like that. But anyway, thank you very much. That was my last question. Thanks for coming. Thanks for listening. Thanks for not walking away.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.